Hi everybody, this is Chris Deasy, and it was so good for my latest nostalgia interview to catch up with Stacey Rand. Now, Stacey has worked at the University of Kent for the last 10 years or so. She's a senior researcher in a research unit that focuses on social care and community-based services. Stacey is also a priest in the Church of England. Now, Stacey's first degree was in natural sciences. She ended up specialising in neuroscience and has also worked in the pharmaceutical industry. Stacey talks about the journey towards ordination, about the relationship between utilitarianism and Christianity, and the diverse range of backgrounds of those training for ministry. We also find out what has tended to happen when people see Stacey wearing a clerical collar, for example, when she's travelling on the bus. Now, Stacey was born in Enfield. She grew up in Hertfordshire. She talks about how she loved being outdoors as a child. Now, faith didn't play such a big role when growing up, but the interest and the curiosity here developed in her time when she was studying at Cambridge, and she was later baptised as an adult. Stacey discusses her musical tastes. She had piano lessons when she was young. That opened up a world of classical music and early music, which she played on the recorder. Stacey is also a member of the University of Kent Chorus. We talk about adapting to doing things differently due to the pandemic, in terms, for example, of data collection. Now, her five-year-old self thought that she would either be a pop star or a librarian. And we discover how Stacey got into natural sciences but nearly ended up following a career in law. We talk about the unexpected impacts of research, and Stacey discusses the importance of keeping one day a week clear from work. Then towards the end of the interview, we talk about the role of looking back and the relationship between positive and negative memories. Stacey talks about the comfort provided by the Book of Job because of how it confronts suffering face on. And at the very end, Stacey discusses how looking back and looking forward often go hand in hand. It was an immense pleasure for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to catch up with Stacey Rand from the University of Kent. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure to have Stacey Rand for my latest nostalgia interview. And Stacey, we were just saying before we started recording that I know you've been at Kent for a number of years. I've often seen you around, but it's only through our Centre for Anglican History and Theology that we've actually, probably in all the years I've been here, had a conversation.
Yes. It's often the way that it goes at the university. I mean, it's a wonderful campus, but we have so many students and staff. And places, certain hubs like the Gulbenkian Cafe, you get to know people's faces and maybe smile and nod. But there often aren't places to have longer conversations. So it's good to be able to be here and speak with you today.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to have you. And of course, just so the listeners can sort of know the context, because we were talking about Don Cupid, a theologian, in the last couple of weeks. And of course, I learned, I'm sure I already knew this, but of course, I learned that you were ordained, and we suddenly found all these fascinating connections. But do you want to say a little bit about what you do at the University of Kent?
Yes, so I've incredibly been there nearly 10 years. I still can't quite believe it. So I work in one of the research units there, which specialises in social care research. Mm. My job title is Senior Research Fellow, so I'm a senior researcher focused on the area of social care, particularly community-based services and quality of life. But as you also noted, I'm ordained. I'm a priest in the Church of England. Actually, today is my fifth anniversary of having been ordained.
Actually, to the day, 1st of July.
Oh, it's fourth anniversary of priesting and fifth of being ordained deacon to the day.
So. Wow. No, huge congratulations. That's great.
Thank you.
And how did you find that sort of fitted in the sense that, you know, because I'm guessing that to be doing social scientific research and being ordained, that's an interesting sort of combination. I'm guessing that you're probably one of not very many people who've got that particular sort of blend.
No. I mean, there are a few other people, but we are few and far between. I suppose it's not where I've ended up is not quite where I'd expected at the beginning of the journey. But I think life's like that for many of us. Yeah. So actually, my first degree is in natural sciences, biological sciences. And I, during that time, it was quite clear that my interests were really in kind of medical sciences. So I did kind of human physiology, psychology, neuroscience, ended up specializing in psychology and went off and did 2 years as a research assistant doing neuroscience research. So, you know, you see these great television programs with people with caps on with electrodes, and that I did that for 2 years. It was great fun. And then after that, looking for work, ended up in the pharmaceutical industry and really enjoyed that very dynamic workplace. Again, using the kind of life sciences background, but in a completely different context. And then, as often happens, I met someone, got married. He finished his PhD and got his first job at the University of Kent. We both moved together to Canterbury. I could have stayed working from home in the pharma industry, but decided I didn't quite like it and it wasn't quite the same, which is saying that it's strange given we've just coming out of 18 months of it being compulsory.
No.
But certainly at the time, it was a shock going from a very busy, dynamic office, open plan office environment to working on my own at home. So I thought, let's look for something locally. And the first job I applied to was the first job I got, and that was the one at the University of Kent, working as a researcher, and spent the last 10 years really getting into that area. So it was not the area I was in before I've moved into it. But I think it fits me perfectly. That's partly why I'm still here and
That,
wanting to come.
that sounds an amazing sort of trajectory, because I remember being at school, secondary school, and there was a teacher who I think he fought in the Second World War, so he would have retired like mid 1980s, and he was he never actually taught me it. He was a very scary figure, but he was a physics teacher. He may even have been the head of physics at my school, but he was ordained, and at the time we were always sort of thinking how interesting, because it turns out, and I only discovered this recently, I think he died only a few years ago, but he had a degree in theology from the same place in the University of Wales in Lampeter where I went. So, of course, all these strange sort of connections that you sort of identify people and you assume that they have, you sort of make assumptions about the sort of, certainly when you're 11 or 12, anyway, you do, you make assumptions about the sort of what somebody is like based on the subject that they're teaching. But of course, they have a huge hinterland. And often, as you just outlined, it's very possible to change careers and in many cases have a very fulfilled life.
Absolutely. And I mean, in parallel to all of this was the theology study. And I think, you know, it does sound like it's this kind of weaving or sort of parallel thing, but I think it a lot's explained if I think about myself as a child, because I always had very diverse and broad interests and was someone who'd like to weave very different things together. So I was always quite happy learning about dinosaurs at the same time as music, and quite liked the diversity. But the journey to ordination, that's quite long. So I think it's about been about 15 years since I first started thinking about it. And it was actually when I moved to Canterbury that I thought, okay, now's the time to kind of take it forward. I went and spoke to someone. So how it works in the Church of England is you get sent off to speak to a diocesan director of ordinands. And we had a conversation. And I was expecting at the end the person to say no. But he said, yeah, I think you're all right. Off you go to the next stage. And it's a very strange process. It lasts a different period of time for different people. But for me, it was 18 months of going off and having, you know, basically a chat with someone once a month. And they ask all kinds of strange questions, get you to explore different things, give you theology books to read. And after that, send you off to a panel. You get together with up to 16 other people also thinking about ordained ministry. And at each stage, I kept expecting them to say no, and they didn't. So that was that kind of parallel track. And I suppose at the point of ordination, I did kind of imagine I might end up as a vicar. So to actually end up as, you know, still working as an academic has been a slight surprise to not just to me, but to everyone. But it works wonderfully well. And there's something quite, there's a tension and kind of challenge in juggling and spinning different plates. But there's something quite fruitful and creative in it at the same time.
Well, you just put me in mind of something. I remember my PhD supervisor saying years ago that sometimes the best kind of research, and you can apply that to, people's careers as well, is when you're on the hinterland between different disciplines, because also it means that you can sort of, and often you never quite know yourself where you're going to tread next. And actually, in that sense, it kind of means that you have a much greater skill set, and also a kind of a more diverse, more rounded kind of way of looking at things. Because this was always my problem in some ways, that you always think, because if you do a PhD in a certain area, then you're a specialist in that area, so you spend the rest of your life doing nothing but that. And in reality, as I know from working in this profession, and maybe the reason I've also been here so long, is because much as I love my research, the amount of time I spend on that compared to being doing pastoral support or being head of department or often writing module specifications. I don't think anybody goes into the profession in order to write module specs, but often you have to do that. And sometimes you think, well, actually, okay, it's a skill I didn't know I had. I don't wake up in the morning and think, this is what I want to be doing today. But there are other things that you think, well, I may be writing module specs today, but tomorrow I might be doing some wonderful work on, I don't know, Don Cupid or something. And I think having that sort of aspiration, and that, interestingly, in some ways at surface level anyway, very discordant sort of set of interests actually kind of ensures that you can keep doing this for decades rather than, a couple of weeks, you think, now it's not for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's that kind of stoking up and challenge that comes, and then the fruit that comes from it. As you were speaking, I was thinking of a few situations where that's happened in both directions. So, as part of training for ministry, I spent 6 years doing a part-time degree in theology, and I'm very glad to report I finished it. 2019, hooray! And one of the essays I had to write was around utilitarianism. And I think the tutor and what we were supposed to write is how utilitarianism and Christianity are incompatible. And given the part of my research overlaps with outcome measure development, and I work with economists, there was a bit of me that felt that that wasn't quite where I wanted to end up. And so ended up writing quite a, I think it was quite fun, challenging essay, trying to look at the ways in which they might be brought into some kind of fruitful dialogue, and was pleased to discover there are proper theologians who kind of work in that area as well. So that was kind of fun. And the other way around as well, quite often I'm doing my social care research and sometimes working, for example, with social workers, and I'm always noticing the way in which the profession of social work has been influenced by Christian ideas and its background, and also sometimes bringing in theological ideas into my way of thinking around social care, particularly in the idea around people, the act of caring. Quite often, social care, when you read about it in the media, it gets reduced to questions around funding. Finances, practical matters. And, really, what it's actually about is relationships and people. And so bringing that lens back in and thinking theologically a bit about that, I found quite a fruitful area as well. Even if it isn't something I publish explicitly, it's kind of there in the background of my thinking.
But it sounds like you were also teaching the tutor in that sense, because you came with a very different, I mean, that was my experience as well, because I used to teach the trainees for a site, and it was actually quite a scary thing at times, because they were I was younger than a lot of the people who were going for ordination training, and they were all in many cases professionals, like diplomats, worked for the Foreign Office, or doctors, GPs. I think there was another guy who had a PhD in philosophy, and I was teaching them, and in some cases they were sort of like, well, we're they, in so many ways, they had a life story that was greater than mine. I was teaching them theology, but they had, had a more varied life, and in many cases they were teaching me. But it was actually probably more intimidating for me, I think, to be teaching them than it was for them to be taught by me.
Well, that's interesting to hear from the other side, because I'm very aware. So you referred to SITE. It's now called, it changed names a few years ago. It's St Augustine's College of Theology, which is one of, there's a network of these local training colleges for people training and preparing for ordained ministry in the Church of England. As you quite rightly say, they pick up a diversity of people who are still usually working in often professional roles, but there's a whole range. We had someone who was by background a builder in my cohort, and then was teaching construction as her job, and someone else in the printing industry. So we had a real diversity. And there's something quite rich in training alongside people bringing these different perspectives and professional backgrounds. And that would often be part of our conversations in the classroom. And over coffee or sometimes in the bar in the evening.
Although one thing I did find is that, whereas when I was teaching 18 and 19 year olds, sometimes they were like, "Oh, I didn't know that. I'm really interested. I'm inspired. I want to go off and learn more about it." What I did find when I was teaching, because it was an evening thing as well, we were going up to Southwark Cathedral and so on, is that it was the opposite. And sometimes they were like, "Why is this guy talking to us about films that we haven't seen?" And I don't know. I'm not quite sure why I was talking about films. That is my research area, but I think whereas I suppose an undergraduate who's choosing a module on religion and film expects you to talk about film, here they were doing a theology program in order to become ordained, and possibly me banging on about Martin Scorsese or whatever probably didn't completely resonate. But that was it was an interesting life experience for me, and it's funny teaching two very disparate groups of students and getting a very sort of different sense of the dynamics involved. So actually for me, I think on the whole it was very beneficial, but at the time, God, it was the most frightening teaching experience I've ever had.
Yes, and I'm nodding. So the audio know I'm nodding vigorously, and I was very aware that as a cohort, I think there were 16 or 17 of us in my group, and we could be quite scary for the tutors coming along. And sometimes within ourselves, the discussion was quite robust. But having got to know each other, it was a good place to be able to have those sorts of conversations. And it's something that sometimes makes me feel a little bit sad, because you hear clergy sometimes saying to each other, "Oh, I studied theology and I've learned all of these things, but I don't use it." And actually, I find that I'm using it all of the time. And I sometimes wonder, is it because I work at a university, because I'm around people who are curious and will ask questions. And so often I find myself wandering around campus, particularly if I'm wearing a clerical collar. People read that as giving them permission that they can come and ask me anything.
And have you found that people who come up to you and ask those questions are people who didn't come up to you before you started wearing the collar?
Yes, absolutely. And again, for those who can't see me, I'm not wearing my clerical collar today. So I do kind of go most of the time without a collar, and maybe a couple of days a week I do. And you do find they're quite different experiences. But I think that's important. You're giving space to different types of people. And I see that as part of what I offer. And as much as a clerical collar does open conversations for some people, it can be actually quite intimidating for others. And I have a very vivid memory pre-COVID of waiting at the bus stop, Canterbury City Centre, for the bus up to campus, wearing my collar, and I got on. And it was like the great parting of the sea as people tried to move away, not to sit next to the vicar.
No, and actually, I've got it from a different vantage point. I find that I can be sitting or standing in front of my students for 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon and talking about death of God theology or something, then go to the supermarket in the evening, and at the till they say, "What do you teach?" And I'm just thinking, "Oh, I knew you're going to ask that." And then as soon as I say I teach religious studies, then you just know that you're opening yourself up to all sorts of conversations, because it's almost like, ah, so in the similar way that they see you wearing a dog collar and they will make all sorts of assumptions about or you represent something that relates to something in their past, or their religious or lack of religious sort of upbringing, etc. I actually find that I can have the most wonderful debates with my students about very controversial things, but when it comes to the sort of why do you teach what you do, or you hear something where I'm no longer in that sort of, I'm not teaching a particular syllabus, and I'm losing the same sort of the contours are not clear. So it's very interesting, but also it must be pretty awkward for you, because you're obviously aware of that, but you're probably trying to just sort of pretend that it's you don't want to be the center of attention.
No, exactly. And I would say I've got, well, I think I've got quite a silly sense of humour. So most of the time I'm trying not to laugh. But yes, it can sometimes be interesting to navigate these different boundaries. But that just comes with being ordained. If you speak to most people who've been ordained, these are the sorts of things and that you have. They're just slightly amplified because of this strange dual, inhabiting of two different roles, a little like your physics teacher. You've got these two quite different hats that you're holding at the same time. And again, as you were saying, being an academic and inhabiting that people bring all kinds of assumptions into conversations with that as well. So yeah, it can be quite interesting.
Absolutely. And how did the journey start for you? Because obviously we're talking nostalgia, but in terms of where were you born? What sort of in terms of like earliest memories, what are the things that you can remember growing up?
So I was born in Enfield. Quite proud of having been born in Enfield for no particular reason other than I was. And I grew up in Hertfordshire, a place called Cheshunt, which most people know is it's where the headquarters of Tesco's is, and it's also where Cliff Richard grew up. I know, so these are the claims to fame. Grew up, I always say it's ordinary, but I suppose different people's definition of ordinary. So for me, that was, mum, dad, sister, living in a terraced house on the edge of a council estate. The road's called Berry Green Road, and that gives a clue as to, what kind of place it was. So it's actually the site of what's been an ancient burial ground or Roman burial ground. And it still has, an active cemetery. So it's quite, growing up as a child, it's quite weird growing up at the end of a road with quite large, still working cemetery. So that was part of the memory in the landscape. And also being on the edge of a housing estate, you've got all of this kind of urban built up, but also the nature. And as a child, just absolutely loved being outdoors, being in woodland. There was a little river, the River Lea. We had part of that flowing past us. So just loved all of that. And as a child, spent a lot of time being outdoors, playing. My dad was also quite enthusiastic in encouraging that. So lots of quite happy memories.
No, and it's funny you mentioned Enfield because the most recent interview I put out with somebody who grew up in Enfield, Bob Bowie from Canterbury Christchurch. So Enfield, clearly there's obviously
Oh,
the
lost.
relationship between Enfield and nostalgia is obviously a very direct one. But actually, it's interesting what you say there because being on that sort of just in the light of what we were saying about interdisciplinary work, isn't it interesting that sort of almost like having both the urban and the rural, literally depending on it's almost from what you're describing, depending which way you looked, you had Sundays you might go into the towards the cemetery, other days more into the urban dwelling, and I think that it's one of those things that I went to university in a very small Welsh town, and it was there was no city, and I loved it, but I also missed the city. When I was in the city, I missed being in Lampeter. When I was in Lampeter, I missed the city. But I suppose an ideal world, and Canterbury actually has that because you've got the seaside, and then you've got the city, and you've got the cathedral, but you've also got lots of countryside, and in some ways you can have all three on the same day. And it sounds like growing up, and I don't know if it was a conscious thing, or maybe I'm trying to, belabor the point, but it's interesting that you were on the precipice, right next to a cemetery. And then obviously you are now ordained, but it sounds as though there may have been sort of questions from a very sort of young age about sort of as it was for me growing up. It's sort of there's a church nearby. I used to go to the church, never quite understood why I was going. And I was when I was very young, I didn't, the sort of issues in theology that I discuss now wouldn't have meant an awful lot to me. But it sounds as though you had some interesting sort of growing up experiences that have kind of followed you through.
Yes, I think there's certainly something there about that kind of being on the boundary and also living somewhere where there's a variety of different landscapes. And so I can see the parallel with Canterbury. I think the reason I live quite centrally and really enjoy it because you've got the urban and yet I can still walk out into the countryside. You've got coast, you can walk to the coast, even though it's a long walk. The same before I moved to Canterbury, I lived in Cambridge. And that's a city with a lot of greenery in the middle. The landscape's not quite as interesting, extremely flat. I often say I lived in Cambridge, and there was a time when I took my car for its MOT, and they told me, "Sorry, your handbrake's broken," and it must have been for quite a while had you not noticed. I think living in Cambridge, no, I hadn't. So yes, I think there's something there about being on the boundary, having these different views. I'm not so sure about the curiosity and link with theological thinking and the burial ground. It's interesting because my parents, neither of them really have much interest in faith or religion. We certainly weren't churchgoers. So my entire experience of Christianity in church up until the age of 18, it consisted really of going to family events, weddings mostly, christenings. And looking back, I was frightfully ignorant, I think, of most things to do with faith. But found I was quite interested when I was reading about the Romans or the ancient Egyptians, about the kind of social aspects. And again, this is probably you can see where it goes, about the social aspects like family life, religious rituals and these kinds of things. And for me, where it really kind of developed into an interest and then into a living faith was at Cambridge. So Cambridge is a city that's just full of churches. You really can't go very far before you trip over another church or another chapel. And they really do declare that they're there because of the bells. So my memory of Freshers' Week and my first term at Cambridge was just thinking, why are there so many bells? And quite quickly, so I was at Queen's College, which is next to King's College, and King's College has a bell that goes every afternoon for evensong. And in that first term, I kept hearing this bell, and I thought, right, I'm going to go and find out what this is. So I often joke that I'm the very small number of people who came to the Church of England through the fresh expression of choral evensong.
Yeah, but isn't that sort of curiosity, that inquisitiveness? It is interesting because when was I went to a church school, and it was never cool in that sense. It was a very kind of, looking back, it was yet very much a Church of Wales school. It was a very, very good school, and we all most people went on to certainly sixth form and university, but it is interesting that the faith questions. It took me to go to university to do a degree in theology, and it made me then think, gosh, all those years of being in a church school, it felt that it was all very kind of a bit sort of by the numbers, really. It was a bit generic and quite a kind of more perhaps secular than perhaps should have been the case. But it's interesting that it made me reflect on that, and it was that lack of coolness. I was one of very few students who did A level religious studies, and it's interesting that the fact that I was in that minority, I think, also made me reflect all the more as to why I was perhaps following a path that seemed right for me, but was very unrepresentative of everybody else. And it's interesting because so you did natural sciences, so you had a completely different sort of background. But it's interesting that you were sort of very keen to try and follow that curiosity through and look where it's taken you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, it's the thing about Cambridge is it's not just the buildings of the church, but it's got quite a lively Christian culture of different denominations. And certainly my memories of the student, the Christian Student Union, are not all entirely positive, entirely positive, but it was quite difficult to get through the university experience completely ignoring them and other forms of Christian expression. And I certainly found that during the 3 years, as the curiosity grew, I was talking to people, and there were a few people in particular who I think noticed the curiosity and were able to kind of channel it in roughly the right direction. And by the time I got to my final year, I got to the point where I was thinking, actually, I feel really drawn to this. And it had developed from an interest or a curiosity into something that was actually something I was inhabiting, something that I was living. And it was towards that, and then the year after I graduated, I was actually baptized and confirmed as an adult, which was a wonderful experience. It kind of grew into that.
Wow, because I'm just thinking that when this was happening, were you able to share these sort of conversations and thoughts, or was it very private to you? I mean, were your other students or your friends aware of this, or was it something that you kind of thought, this is my own space, and maybe it's taken a lot longer to be disseminated?
It was, I think, lively conversations. And again, it wasn't for everyone, but there were a few people in particularly my year who were very interested. So we had one theology or divinity student who was very happy to chat about all kinds of things over coffee. But there was also, I don't think it was Christian Union, but there was a different kind of group that was kind of an eclectic group of different Christians. And we'd meet once a week for breakfast. And that was also a safe space to kind of talk and discuss some of these things. That was really important. And then, actually, in preparing to be baptized and confirmed, the church that I went to offered a 9-month program with a group of us. So there were actually two of us who were baptized, and I think five confirmed. And that was a lovely format because we basically had Wednesday evenings, cup of coffee. They'd invite someone to come and give us a chat, and we'd sit round, and it was anything. You could ask anything, talk about anything. It was all fine.
And one thing as well that I always ask almost obsessively about, because, well, or rather it's an obsessive interest for me growing up, which has sort of followed through, which at face value has nothing to do with my research or another. It's music in the charts, and the sort of, I grew up, I mean, you mentioned choral music and so on, but I'm still in that sort of mindset. Whenever I hear a sort of Sounds of the 80s program on the radio, it's like, that is my era, and I just gravitate towards that. And it's very interesting because it's not necessarily the path. I was never the coolest kid in school, and yet I was always so, that for me, listening to the radio, waiting for the charts to come out on a Tuesday lunchtime, was so sort of endemic to of that sort of era. But do you have any similar sort of experiences in terms of, say, musical or filmic backgrounds?
My mum absolutely loves music. So she never had the opportunity to learn an instrument, but she's just really passionate about music. So my memories of childhood was quite often with music playing in the background. And one of my earliest memories is my mum putting a record on. And it was only recently, for ages, I just didn't have a clue what the music was, but I think it was Money by Pink Floyd. So I remember her playing that. She'd play all different, quite eclectic kind of jazz, a lot of pop, things again from the 80s. I was born 82, so I've got, small childhood memories of listening to all different kinds of things. But for me, the musical taste diverged slightly. My granddad taught himself to play the keyboard, and I must have been about 7 or 8, and he came to babysit. And I have this memory of him watching a concert pianist on the television. And for whatever reason, this thing caught my imagination. And I spent probably 2 years bugging my parents for piano lessons till they finally caved in. And from that whole world of classical music opened up. And again, it was mostly piano music because that was my instrument, but got into orchestral music, so Beethoven, Sibelius. And then when I went to Cambridge, it was just because the choral tradition was so strong. That became an interest. And then from that, actually, something I'm quite passionate about is early music. So I play very badly the recorder, but mostly driven by this interest and passion in early music and trying to be able to play some of the pieces I enjoy listening to, often very badly. And I feel sorry for my neighbour.
Well, actually, it's funny you say that because it's the place I went to university is it's going to be 200. It's next year will be the 200th anniversary, and there's going to be a concert where the whole evening will be spent listening to music that was either from or was listened to in 1822. So, of course, and this is I'm you know far far more than I would, I'm sure, but I find that really interesting because obviously my nostalgia in that sense seems rather more sort of superficial, I suppose, in many ways. I was like, oh, what was in the charts in 1982? But it's very interesting, but I find that fascinating in terms of the way, because obviously I'm interested in living memories as well, because obviously nobody, there's nobody who was from 1822 who's still with us, but in terms of the history and the culture and that. And being at Cambridge, you obviously would have completely imbibed that. And I find that so enriching, the way in which sometimes you're looking at something like with my parents, similar to what you say with the record. I have very, very vivid memories of my dad putting on, Buddy Holly or Lonnie Donegan or the Everly Brothers, and that has absolutely carried with me. So I don't know anymore where, his interests end and mine begin. They completely cross over and dovetail with one another.
I think it's a very strong influence. I remember I must have been about 12 or 13 and sort of came home and I was talking to my mum, and someone in my class had been talking about the Beatles, and I had no idea who they were, and my mum was terribly disappointed and said, right, well, we're going to have to educate you. That was wonderful, getting her collection out and listening and discovering that music for myself. There's something really quite wonderful in that being passed on. And then actually, because with the piano lessons, learning, I could then play, and then with other friends who were playing, guitar and different things, we'd quite often, make some music ourselves. It's just a real joy of that kind of passing on of meaning and then being able to make it your own.
Yeah, and do you still do that? Do you still play with other friends?
No, it's a sadness. It gets sometimes more and more difficult, but I do enjoy, I sing very badly, but I sing well enough to sing in large groups. So I'm a proud member of the University of Kent Chorus.
Ah, because
And that I enjoy.
no, that sounds spectacular. Because I was just thinking, because I've seen so many people, including at the university, maybe you're involved in this, where through Zoom, or you have all the sort of the online choir. I have no idea technically and logistically how it works, but it is so impressive to watch. You've got all the different on the screen. You've got the small, that you can just about make everybody out, and they're all wonderfully in unison. I'm thinking, I'm sure, I don't know whether this was all being wonderfully edited or something, because I can't imagine that something that beautiful can be replicated over Zoom with people having connectivity issues. But that sounds like something that actually during lockdown to watch, if not to actually participate in, was a great communal experience at a time that we were physically separated.
Yeah. So I did try doing the remote thing, and I struggled slightly, I have to say, but it's been a joy. I've been watching what other people have been producing, and I found it really invigorating, the level of creativity and how people have been able to produce these things. And I can't remember the people's name, but there was a, I think, semi-professional singer who'd done various pieces of music, him singing all of the parts and putting them together. Or you can just see the way in which family or bubbles have come together and made music. And sadly, I've not found my own outlet for that other than my own piano and recorder. So I'm looking forward to, as the restrictions lift, being able to resume singing in the chorus and other music making.
No, it is interesting though, isn't it, as to how lockdown has, I mean, it might be worth talking in a minute about how that has played out in terms of your own, work, because I had this real sense back in March 2020 that, as somebody who, although I do these interviews and I'm used to sort of, you'd think, go around with microphones, I was always interviewing people face to face. But then suddenly teaching, it's like, how can I not teach my students face to face? And I found it so daunting. But then suddenly within a matter of days, it was just apparent that, it shows how creative we are as a species, really, because suddenly we just made this transition, albeit in some cases, doing it from weird places like, children's bedrooms, or, sort of, or people would put fake backgrounds on. So there was a way of suddenly life carried on, even though it looked as though the way of life as we knew it was, for an indefinite period, was going to be completely suspended.
Absolutely. It has been quite a strange experience. But again, as you were saying, I've noticed just how quickly I've adapted and colleagues have adapted. So actually thinking back to the very beginning of, the pandemic, the first lockdown, at that point, I was 6 months into a new project. And we started, so often with my research, it involves data collection. That could be by surveys or a little bit like this. I go around and chat to people, doing interviews with them, and collect survey responses in the interviews and look at the data and try and make sense of it. So the project we were working on was actually a survey. It was meant to be postal and online, and we started it 2 weeks before the first lockdown. So actually, it's been quite an interesting experience having to keep adapting to the different circumstances, often quite rapidly and creatively. I've had a very good researcher working with me who's just full of very creative ideas. And we've actually finished data collection about 8 weeks ago, managed to get a full survey completed and doing the analysis now. But it has been slightly strange having to just adapt so many times to make that happen.
Yeah, and do you think that the quality of the research in that sense, because I found it with marking, marking students' work, that amazingly, I thought at first, oh, students are not going to submit, and no, they did submit, and even though they haven't got access to the library, the quality of work is very good. But do you kind of feel that it changes the way that future research will be done now that we know that we have this extra sort of outlet for doing
Yes.
what we do?
Yeah. Oh, no, I can see that happening. Absolutely. I mean, for years, usually, so with my research, I'm either speaking with professionals or care workers, or I'm talking to people using care services and their family. And the wisdom has been for many years that when you're talking with professionals, that you do it by phone or remotely, and that's fine. But when you go and speak to people and their families, then you ought to go in person. But actually, in the adapting to it, it works perfectly fine. Not always, but often it works perfectly fine doing it remotely. And in some ways, it allows people a bit more space to open up. And I find that really interesting. Obviously, I miss the cup of tea and quite often a slice of cake that comes. But it does seem to work in some ways. So I imagine in the future that we'll continue to have these other tools, these other ways of doing things. And it means that for some people who couldn't participate before, they can. And I think that's a really positive thing.
Yeah, no, you just reminded me because I remember being in primary school and we were watching some, it would have been like a children's version of Tomorrow's World. And it was sort of like in the future, people will talk to each other through, not through the telephone, but actually through like television screens and you can see the other person. And so I was like, I don't know, 6 or 7 at the time. And I thought, that's never going to happen. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. How can you see the other person that you're talking to? And yet, of course, I didn't even use Skype before, or maybe once or twice, and that was a meeting that somebody else had arranged. And suddenly now, of course, there isn't a single day when I'm not on a Teams or a Zoom call. But it's interesting what it can do. You know, I mean, for my own interview series, you know, I've interviewed people from Canada, New Zealand, anywhere in the world, which, of course, in the past, I would be like, oh, well, let me know when you're in the UK. And we'll catch up and we'll do the interview. And now it's a case of, oh, you know, regardless of where in the world you are, what time's good for you tomorrow? And it's absurd. But at the same time, like you, I do miss those face-to-face meetings. I actually like the travel, going to seaside town, places I've never been to before, and just sort of, you know, so meeting the person and spending an hour or two in their company, in their environment. And that for me was really enriching.
Absolutely. And you do miss a lot. So obviously there you with Zoom, you still get the conversation, you get to see people's faces, but those other aspects of the experience are definitely missing. And I mean, I think I've been reflecting a bit about the experience of the last 18 months, and I do think that I perhaps had a little bit of a head start in this. So earlier I spoke about the 4 or 5 years I spent working in the pharmaceutical industry. The company I worked for, its UK headquarters was in Cambridge, but it's actually had national headquarters in the US and offices right the way across the globe. And my job involved working with people across different regions. And so I would regularly work with people who I'd never met. I'd often go to the States and I'd get to know people in that office, but I couldn't spend the whole time on the plane. And we would quite often use either telephone, or we would use quite primitive version of Zoom, which was very slow and quite clunky. But it was something of that experience of how do you build rapport, how do you build a working professional relationship with people who you've never met, and in some cases even managing people remotely. And there are ways of doing it, but it's different, quite different from the real life.
No, you're right. And you know, I've got colleagues here at university who I've never actually seen in the flesh. Because I've only they may have started working in the last 18 months and they've never even set foot on campus. So they actually got the interview was online, they work online, and you see them every day, but you know you've never actually seen them physically, and it's very odd. And I even found it with my own students when we did have face-to-face teaching in the autumn of 2020, and because I was so used to seeing them online, when they were in the room, the students who I imagined to be like really big were very small, and they were wearing face masks. So actually, I was looking at it thinking, I actually don't. And of course, they were sitting in particular clusters, and on the screen, it's a bit random as to where they are. Like somebody might be in the top left or the bottom right, but in the room, you know, they're sitting with people that I wouldn't necessarily, you know, have any reason to know whether they were friends or not. And it took me so long to adapt. And also wearing those visors when suddenly, of course, they start steaming up when you start speaking. And I just thought, I actually quite like this, the online teaching. I think the students did as well, if I'm honest. So it's funny how we adapt. But I was going to ask, you know, natural sciences. What how did you end up studying natural sciences? What was the reason for doing that for your degree?
So it wasn't necessarily again where I thought I was going. You know, you as a child, when people ask you what do you want to be when you were when you're grown up. So I started off aged 5 that the two choices in my head were either a pop star or a librarian. Natural choices, I think, to get together. Partly fueled by my love of music and my love of books. But that evolved, and I remember getting to about 11, and perhaps because of television programs, you see, you know, lawyers and this kind of thing. And I've got an aunt who works as a paralegal in London and sort of being influenced by that. So I sort of had this idea I'd go and study law and I'd become a lawyer. And that stuck for quite a long time, as the interest. And then I remember getting to about 17 and I went and did work experience. I was 16, 17. I spent a wonderful week at Stevenage Magistrates Court, which actually I've got to say I've got very positive experiences. It was really fascinating, and that really for me I thought was very interesting. But one of the barristers that I got to chat to different people, the clerks and so on, one of the barristers was quite downbeat and said, "Oh, you don't want to be a lawyer, we don't earn a lot, be an engineer." That was the career advice. And then the second experience was spending a week in a law firm in London. And that was less positive because I realized just how much photocopying is involved. I mean, it may have changed now, but it's very admin heavy. And that got me thinking a little bit, is this quite the right thing? Obviously, there's a specialist knowledge, the technical side. So I ummed and ahed, nearly did apply to do law, but in the end applied to do natural sciences because this was really the other interest and passion. It was the curiosity for the natural world, for the human body, medicine, this kind of thing. But I knew I didn't want to be a doctor because I'm extremely squeamish.
It's funny, isn't it, how sometimes you imagine when you're young that you're going to be a particular thing. In some cases, in my case, if I was asked at the age of 5 or 6, what do you want to do? And the answer would be probably the answer I'd give now. When I've grown up, I want to be on the radio, that sort of thing. And it's really funny. But also in the real world, sometimes, you have to navigate all sorts of, choices. And sometimes, it's, if you want to walk on the moon, it's a great ambition, but does that mean you're going to be bitterly disappointed? And, the chances are you're not going to, I'm sure there are more people who want to walk on the moon than actually do that. But that doesn't mean to say that the wonder and the excitement doesn't go away. But do you find, there must be a sort of a reflection sometimes, and especially if you're still in touch with people who were contemporaries of yours when you were doing natural sciences at Cambridge, who themselves may have moved in very different sort of directions. And there must be a sense in which you're all like, how did we end up now doing what we're doing now? When, if 20 odd years ago, you may have actually perhaps had all had different designs.
And it's interesting. So my intake in my college was a very strong year for sciences and mathematics. So I feel very sorry for the other subjects because they were hugely overwhelmed by us. And I've not kept in touch with everyone, but I've kept in touch with some people. And by and large, we're all still working in the broad realm of science and technology. Quite a few of us are academics, quite a few working in industry. And that I think looking back, I know I was very passionate and still am, even if I'm not working in natural sciences, but social sciences. There's something about the scientific method, the curiosity, the freedom to, I suppose, think and explore things in the world around you, including in, the people, the psychology and social interactions. And that I think is still a passion. And for many of my contemporaries, that's still there. I think particularly for those of us in academia, sometimes it's hard just because it is quite a grueling pathway to take. I often say this to kind of younger people or people thinking of going into academia. You've got to have quite a thick skin because of the criticism. You've got to be very persistent. And quite often it's many years of doing something before it comes to fruition. So even if you're not patient, you just need to be stubborn.
And I think that's a very good bit of advice because, I mean, often the same people, the academics, who are obviously, it's their job, it's our job, my job, to mark students' work. And if it's not worth, if it's not a first class piece of work, the student might be disappointed if they get a lower mark. But my job is to give it a fair mark and give good feedback. But in if we publish anything, and the publisher or the reviewers that the publisher contacts don't like it, we start crying foul sometimes. Like, how dare that person, that anonymous person, but I think I know who it is, how dare they say all these things? But you are right, and it works both ways. But in a way, if you have a real passion for what you do, then of course you're bound to be defensive, and in that sense, kind of feel that there are certain vulnerabilities sometimes which will arise in those sort of contexts when we are, if you like, where the students are, but that we're teaching just the boot. It's on the other foot.
And I often can't quite believe I do what I do because there's a great joy and real privilege to be able to, focus full time on research. So in my role, I don't really teach. I do maybe little bits of postgraduate, but it's mainly focused on the research. And in terms of that, I have to sometimes do projects or get allocated to projects, or we get the funding and we have to do this. But there's also a huge amount of freedom of developing and pursuing your interests. And often then sometimes seeing those in the real world. So one piece of work that I did was a few years ago, translating a questionnaire that I was involved in developing, a questionnaire that asked family carers about their well-being, their quality of life. Because what's known is that family members who care for a relative or close friend who's got a disability or condition, it can impact on life in all kinds of ways. People can get isolated, not being able to carry on in work, these kinds of things. And so there was interest in Japan. I worked with a colleague, got translated. And then it's used now as a research tool, potentially could be used in assessing carers' needs in Japan. And it's also been adopted by a care provider out there as part of their mission statement. We're supporting people, and these are the areas we're going to help them. So it's wonderful to kind of be in an area of research where you can see other people picking up the vision and the idea in it, doing something in the real world.
No, I can imagine in that sense how gratifying it must be when you work on a project and don't always know what the outcomes are going to be, but then it's picked up often by somebody you've never heard of, or somebody in a field that you've never come across, and they're actually saying, "Oh, there are insights here which I'm going to use." And there's actually it's wonderfully gratifying. And I suppose it's the closest analogy I can think of is when a student they may have graduated 5 or 10 years ago, but says, "Oh, because of that essay I wrote for your module, I want to be a teacher. I want to do this. I want to do that." And that, and somehow they say, I didn't think I wanted to do it at first, but on reflection, this is the path I want to take. Can you write a reference? And that's actually really nice, because it shows that the work that you're doing has some longevity. It's not just something that you put into a box. Some people perhaps would just, project done, end of. But for me, there needs to be some sort of context to that. And I guess it's the people who both directly and indirectly benefit from the work that we do. And otherwise, why would we carry on doing it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know that there's a push to kind of, formalize or measure the impact of research. And I think, that's fine. That's something that we do. But quite often, the actual impact of the research is something that you may not have predicted at the beginning. And it can be quite surprising sometimes where things go. And there's also these kind of more subtle impacts, like you're describing with students. And I certainly know my own path and my own career has been hugely influenced by people who supported or encouraged along the way. Sometimes people have only met once or twice for a coffee, but have often some thoughts and advice. And I often ponder in the way in which people present their life or career narrative, particularly on social media. The focus is often, on them and, what they've achieved and their successes. It often misses out this kind of backstory of, serendipity or conversations or supporters in the background who've helped them find their path and for this flourishing to come.
No, I think that's right. Because sometimes when you watch a film, you've got all these people who are involved, from the caterers, the cinematographers, the musicians. There's thousands of people who are, maybe involved in a film. But with a novel sometimes, or a book, you just see that one name and you think, oh, that person wrote. And of course, yeah, they did write it, in the same way that a film director directs the film. But the idea that they do it in isolation without a community of people to bring that project to fruition, I think is the thing. And conversely as well, I think that it's the impact that the research has on the individual. Maybe that's the thing for me, because I always need that hook. If somebody's going to stand up and tell me why they're doing a particular project, it might have wonderful impact, but I'm also thinking, what about the impact on you? In other words, why are you doing that? If I know what that hook is, I'm with you. Otherwise, I'm just thinking, oh, there's a lot of jargon in this, or so what? You have to tell me what it is that matters, and that's what inspires me.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking now, actually, I've not made this connection before, but again, in the conversation, it's sort of come to the front of my mind. I wonder whether some of this is because my career's gone out of academia and back in. And certainly in the pharmaceutical industry, you're very aware that there's a huge number of people involved, hundreds, thousands in getting a drug from the initial idea, into use and to the market. And often this is something that people have no idea about. I think COVID has been brilliant in terms of uncovering the industry and what it does. But there was a sense of some of the projects I worked on were really large. And I knew that what I was doing was important and I was contributing, but I was only one person in a really vast operation. And I think there's something quite healthy about that balance, knowing that what you're doing is meaningful and important. I remember this one drug in particular, then going on a spa day with my sister and my mum, had my hair cut, and I was talking to the hairdresser. He had the condition and was taking the drug I'd been involved in developing and was talking about what impact it had. You can see these connections, and yet also saying, you know, I'm one part of a huge number of people who've been involved in this, and just being able to stand back and I suppose admire that collaborative working and creativity.
Because I've always kept a diary, and it's so interesting to go back and see, like when I was doing my PhD, I'll go back to the entries at the time and I was like, oh, this is what I was working on today. And of course, you can see 20 or more years later how that became, integral to the thesis, or that, oh, that was chapter four or whatever. But at the time it was like, oh, where's this going? And it may be a waste of time and it may not actually go anywhere. But when you've actually finished that project, looking back, it takes on a completely different significance, because what at the time might have seemed a bit random, and you may be unsure of yourself, because you know that it all fitted in, you start to see all these sort of connections. And in some ways, it's also a case of distorting the past, because you're looking at the past from the point of view of the end goal, rather than necessarily from the time when you when maybe actually you were convinced that this actually was a load of rubbish, but it's only in time that you say, oh, actually, maybe, maybe there was a method to all of this, and it was all, it was all falling into place. But do you have any of those sort of experiences? Do you sort of, are you able to look back on those previous projects and start to see that actually that they move you into areas that you wouldn't have expected at the time?
Yes, I suppose a little bit. Although I've got to admit, my mind was moving on to a slightly different topic because I'm aware we're talking a lot about things that we do. And recently, it's wonderful now the restrictions have lifted, and I'm occasionally going and meeting people for coffee and lunch. And I met someone for lunch recently and was talking about what I do. And at the end, the person said, "Gosh, I feel exhausted. It sounds like you do a lot." And that challenged me slightly. You know, I'm academic, I'm doing ordained ministry. And actually, I think there's a whole part that's missing. And there's something I find very important about the art of doing not a lot, doing nothing. And certainly in my weekly pattern, I try and keep one day a week that's clear. And that is really important to me. The rule for that day is no work and to do as many enjoyable things as possible. So it's a time for catching up with family and friends, you know, going for a nice walk, listening to music, making music, spending time with my husband, all of these kinds of things. And I think that's vitally important and often is a missing part of the narrative because without that pausing and stopping, there isn't the creativity or the space to think around connections. Like you were talking about looking back, you just wouldn't have space to do that.
And that's interesting, because I'm always doing that kind of, what was I doing on this day? And actually involuntarily as well, but also, I suppose, because I write a diary, I guess I'm already in that mindset. So I do think like that. But it is interesting. I suppose Facebook can do that as well, but it says, this is what you were doing 4 years ago today, and you were like, oh my goodness, I was with that person doing that in that place. And then that sets you on a spiral, which can be in many ways productive, but it is interesting sometimes just to actually remember those dots, because otherwise I think you're in danger sometimes of losing all sense of balance, because sometimes we need order and structure and purpose. And I think unless we have that, then there is that question of, but why are you gonna, if you're gonna do what you're doing for another 20, 30 years, well, great, but there must be a reason why you want to do that rather than something else.
And I think, particularly in the Christian tradition, but I know other traditions, and also in the secular world, you have often annual rhythms and seasons. And I find those really helpful because it without the not the Facebook looking back, but you often I often find myself when I come, for example, to Advent, I think back to previous beginnings of Advent. Or the other big one is always having lived and worked at universities in university towns and worked at universities is the beginning of term and that wonderful sense of, you know, the new start, and often then think back. And I think they're important points, they're important markers. And certainly during lockdown, I was speaking to a few people who said that they'd lost a sense of the passing of time. And I know I did, and a few other people tried things to try and kind of amplify it slightly. So I always have an Advent wreath. my husband's German, so this is quite a big thing. So we always have that. And then we had our Christmas lights, and then we decided to try Epiphany lights as well. And then a Lent display, and we had an Easter tree. So these were all kind of visual ways of trying to mark the passing in time and seasons to try and give that structure back.
Yeah, no, it's definitely therapeutic. And just as we start to wrap up, Stacey, this is the point in the interview. I always ask the question, whether your memories are predominantly positive, but conversely with that, whether it's possible to be nostalgic about, negative experiences.
Yeah, no, I've heard you ask this and other people, and think it's a very interesting question. In terms of positive or negative, I'm not sure. I certainly have positive and negative memories, and also some that I would describe as neutral. And certainly looking back, there's often an immediate draw to positive memories. They seem to be very strong. But I think certainly those negative memories can be very useful, particularly where there's been something that's happened that's quite challenging. And that sense of looking back and maybe even being nostalgic about it is part of making sense of that episode, having learnt from it and then reintegrating it into something that makes meaning. So that I think is certainly where I'd be.
Yeah, because also in terms of the theology or the pastoral side of what you do, I mean, you're obviously dealing with people where issues around suffering and a sense of purposelessness and are going to come up, and I think that, and also of course it's challenging for you and anyone in your position, and it applies no differently to counsellors in that sense or senior tutors or whatever. But you're dealing with people often at their most vulnerable, and you're trying to find some way of giving them some sort of hope when actually in many ways what they may be dealing with is just completely debilitating and awful to behold. But do you kind of find that there's a way through dealing with that actually ensures that you can keep your own head above the water, as it were?
So actually at the moment we're in morning prayer in the Church of England. We're reading through the book of Job, which I love the book of Job. It's a really wonderful book. And I find that deeply comforting, that it's a book that actually doesn't try and cover over suffering with platitudes. It confronts it face on. There's something about Job having the space to kind of do this questioning and pondering. And yet God is still God at the end. So I find that very an important image, and certainly for me when I'm either offering or trying to offer comfort to people who are going through difficulty, or certainly when I've had difficult times myself, I think the most powerful can just be being with people. And certainly in the face of human suffering, I think often because we feel empathy, it's painful to be around someone who's suffering, and often the instinct is to draw away. And this is why people who are suffering end up isolated. And I think it's hugely powerful if you've got the strength, you can find that strength in yourself just to be with someone and accompany them through the darkness, that they know that you're there, can be very powerful and very comforting.
Yeah, no. I think that's a really good way of looking at it, because it also means that you can be true to yourself in the sense that much as you'd like to wave a magic wand sometimes and just let that person that's also not something that is always possible. So in that sense, it's hard when you really want to help someone, but you also realise that what they're going through is way outside anybody else's ability to be able to take away their suffering. But you can ease and you can empathise and you can whether physically or metaphorically hold their hand.
Absolutely. And I think we shouldn't overlook the skill of psychology. So in my first degree being psychology, people who train in clinical psychology and the other kind of therapies around that. I think that's, there's been huge advances, and I know there are challenges in accessing some of these therapies, but I think that's done a lot to be able to open people to understanding themselves and coming to new understandings. Certainly sometimes trying to make sense of things that have been very difficult in lives, but helping them to make some sense and move forward. So I often find myself saying that with clergy, I don't see myself as like a psychologist. I'm not a therapist, but we can certainly be part of the kind of team of people, the kind of cohort of people helping individuals. Therapists have those extra skills and ways of being able to guide and help people through some very difficult places.
Yeah, absolutely. And my very last question, Stacey, is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I say both.
Yeah.
Yes.
Some people have angrily said neither, both, end of.
No, I think both. Certainly for me, there's something about the curiosity and creativity that I do often find the looking back and looking forward go hand in hand. And I'm someone who has never formally studied, but I'm quite interested in history and story. As a way of making sense of now to be able to look forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, well, Stacey, it has been so wonderful to get an insight into all the actually really amazing of psychology, natural sciences, theology, ministry, social scientific, research. So it's been a wonderful sort of tapestry. And thank you for being my guest this week.
Okay, thank you. Good to speak with you.